Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. And on our show today, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. Dr. Christy Page is on vacation this week, so we're actually going to have two interviews. The first one with Dr. Dean Carlin, the author of More Than Good Intentions, a really fascinating and important book that is getting tremendous publicity across the United States and internationally. And we'll also be talking a little bit later in the show with Adam Searing of the North Carolina Justice Center about what's happened in the recent North Carolina legislature about healthcare reform. So we'll be going from international aid to healthcare reform and everywhere in between. First, let me introduce our first guest on the show today, because we're decided to have actually two guests today, and I think this will be an interesting format for our listeners. I want to welcome Dean Carlin, who is professor of economics at Yale University and president and founder of Innovations for Poverty Action. He is the author of a new book called More Than Good Intentions, How New Economics is Helping to Solve Global Poverty. Welcome to Your Health, Dean Carlin.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Dean, this is really a fascinating book, a fascinating topic, and one that I think maybe many of our listeners wouldn't be familiar with. Tell us a little bit about you and your background. You're an economist. You've received many awards nationally and internationally, really a young economist from what I can read. How did you get interested in this whole field of poverty? Because I'm not sure everyone would just see this leap between interest in economics and poverty.
I got into it basically by I was actually a political science major in undergraduate, and I was interested in international issues and issues of poverty. And I went to El Salvador for what was supposed to be a year to work with a microcredit organization in 1992. And in that year, this was just a couple of years after I finished college, I was really enamored with the idea of what the organization was doing, but really struck by how little they knew about what their impact was and whether it was working or not, and why they were doing what they were doing rather than some other approach. How do you choose across good ideas? And when I asked them about what types of impact studies they had done, the studies they showed me were not in any way answering the question. They were asking people, how have you done? How has your business grown over the past 2 years? How has your health improved? How's your income improved? And I didn't have a training in economics, but I knew enough to know that there was no way for them to attribute in a causal way those changes to their program, and that there's lots of other things that are happening, everything from macroeconomic conditions to roads getting built to other government and NGO services being offered. And there had to be some basis of comparison, some measure of what would have happened to these people's lives had this micro-lending organization not offered them credit.
Well, and what's interesting in your book, you describe this kind of initial experience that initially might have been short and turned out to be longer than you anticipated as somewhat of a failure, but also a life-changing event. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I refer to it in the book as the single biggest professional failure of my life, and it is true, although I learned from it. My task at hand there was to build a software system for this micro-lending organization, and I think it's accurate to say that there's not a single piece of software that I coded that lasted more than 3 to 4 years with that organization. And when I left, I, moved on and was very much interested in the research side of the work in poverty to try to address these issues that I was concerned with. But the actual work that I was doing for what was a year turned into 3 years, really never had any positive impact, unfortunately.
Well, I think the positive impact certainly was on you and your ability to see things in a different light. Let's dive right a little bit into the book, the More Than Good Intentions, because, you know, I think you hit at the core of something that's important. I've done some volunteer work internationally with several nonprofit groups, and you talk about the impact of poverty, that 3 billion people live on $2.50 a day across the world, and yet we've spent $2.3 trillion on poverty reduction efforts on the past 50 years. And so you ask kind of these two fundamental questions, which is you wanted to, I sound like, to understand the problem and then how to know what works. Tell us a little bit about how you really framed it that way.
So the reason we framed it that way is, you know, in some sense we're repeating back the framing that we often hear, which is two polar opposite arguments. One saying, we've poured lots of money in, we've made a big impact, but we just need to pour more money in to make an even bigger impact. And then there's another argument that says, no, it's all been wasted and nothing's ever really changed and you haven't done any good at all. And the main thrust of the work that we're doing at our nonprofit is, and also as part of our academic research, is to say, actually, the answer is somewhere in between. And when you say it so bluntly and kind of bashfully, it actually seems kind of obvious that, you know, that it's not that everything works and it's not that nothing works, that the challenge is figuring out what works and what doesn't. And the answer is not going to be found by sitting here in an ivory tower looking at large data sets that compare one country to another, but instead it's going to be found by going to the ground and setting up good, clean, careful tests to find out what really works and what does not. What are some of the key lessons that do transcend across places, and which ones are not? And when they're not transcending across different from one place to another, what are some of the key themes that we can at least pick up on, so we can understand better how to try to tackle poverty when we enter into a new scenario?
We're talking with Dean Carlin, the author of More Than Good Intentions. You know, Dean, you talk about and introduce the randomized controlled trial, the RCT, at the beginning of the book. This is kind of the gold standard of everything that we've thought about in medicine for the last couple decades. And so it resonated clearly with myself. But it sounds like that this was, and maybe still is, something kind of radical when you look at nonprofit work and aid and poverty. Is it?
It is still controversial, I would say. I think part of the issue is that it has caught a lot of popularity, and I think some of the pushback is in response to an argument that no one's really making, which is unfortunate because it kind of ruins the conversation.
Which is what?
Which is that people who propose that we do randomized trials to measure poverty say we should do it everywhere. But nobody ever really makes that claim. We all are very fast, the ones of us who are doing randomized trials to measure poverty are very fast to see the settings in which it's an appropriate tool and the settings in which it's not an appropriate tool.
Can you give an example of each of those? Help
sure. So, you know, there's, if you one is going to go in, let's stay within the healthcare system. If someone is going to go in and try to do an intervention which is changing the healthcare system at a state level, going into the Ministry of Health and providing technical advisory services to the Minister of Health about how to better organize the entire country's health system.
Sounds reasonable, sure.
That, you know, you can't randomize over countries where you do this and where you don't. So you can't, that's just not an appropriate tool for using that. Similarly, there's a lot of good work that needs to be done on diagnostics, understanding what the actual problem is in the first place and where there are needs. And again, that's good research that needs to be done that is not an appropriate tool for a randomized trial. It's answering a different question. So some of it is about when the question is simply not one that one answers with a randomized trial. And other times it's just that the setting is not appropriate. Either the level of intervention is too big, it's at the country level or a large state, or is it too small? It's someone working in one village, and it's a very small but nimble NGO that might look like it's doing a really good job at what it's doing, but it realistically is only operating in one or two villages, and it's operating on a tight budget, and it might, to a qualitative process and a casual eye, might seem like it's doing a really good job. And it's just not an appropriate place to be doing a randomized trial. It's just too small.
Well, before we take a break, which we'll need to in just a second, if you could, for our listeners, define what you mean by microfinance, and what are one or two assumptions that you began to look at over a body of research about that whole field and the type of research that you would then look in to say, these are some ways we can actually study whether or not those assumptions are true.
Sure. So it's microfinance. First of all, let me start off by saying there's two terms that are thrown out a lot. One is microfinance and one is microcredit. And in helping to define the difference between the two, I'll give you the answer to the second part of your question. So microcredit is about giving people small loans. Now, the way the microcredit industry has often worked is by adding an important addendum to that, which is to say, giving people small loans to invest in their enterprise. Now, that second part is actually something that is growing more controversial. Why should we only be lending money to people to invest in their enterprise? Now, one of the reasons we give is that it helps attract more money from fundraising in America. Because Americans like funding the idea of entrepreneurship. That's sexy. It sells. If we were to put into marketing brochures, we want to give people small loans so that they can buy a television or they can build a wall for their home or that they can eat better one month, that's not going to sell as well. And so I think that's one of the reasons why the microcredit industry doesn't push that type of use of funds. However, that is how a lot of the money is used. And I think that's actually a good thing. This is helping people do things that they want to do. Now, there's healthy ways of doing it, and there's unhealthy ways of doing it.
And that's
where we get into what microfinance is.
And I'm going to put a bookmark there because we're going to need to take a short break. When we come back, I want to really pick up on that and really move into understanding the types of experiments you've done, both in the microfinance area and the microcredit to understand outcomes, and then also in the healthcare outcomes. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dean Carlin, about more than good intentions. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today, Dr. Page is on vacation, and I've been talking, though, with author Dean Carlin about his new book, More Than Good Intentions. And right before we broke, Dean, you were talking about the difference between microcredit and microfinance, and I think we're going to give us some examples of some assumptions that perhaps you found that either were true or weren't true.
Sure. Well, one of the most important things we found, and it goes to write about what the definition of microcredit versus microfinance is. So microcredit is about small loans, whereas microfinance includes other services such as savings and insurance. And one of the most striking things that we found in credit is that it's not the silver bullet to rip people out of poverty. Now, to many people, that's not a surprise, but to many, it has been. Now, the striking thing, though, that I think surprises most people is that the biggest impact we've seen of the three studies that have been done on credit using randomized trial methods, we found the biggest impact on the one that was not making any attempt to lend to entrepreneurs. It was actually doing consumer lending that was looked and smelled more like payday lending in America. And yet that was the setting in South Africa where we saw the biggest positive impact on income. And the story was very simple, was that it was helping people absorb shocks. It was helping people absorb a shock, which if they didn't manage to absorb, was going to cost them their job. Something like sending money home to a rural area or fixing a car or vehicle that needed to be fixed to get to their job.
So it wasn't all about this entrepreneurism business sense that we might think of with microcredit. It had to do with many more pervasive cultural societal factors.
Exactly.
Well, that in and of itself is a pretty impressive changing the way I and I'm sure many listeners would look at some of these issues. How do these things play out in some of the assumptions that where you were looking at randomized controlled trials as it affects healthcare?
So on healthcare, there's been a tremendous amount of work, and obviously this is a setting in which there's been a bit more openness, I would say, to doing randomized trials from the very beginning since it's so close to to people's hearts from the medical community. And there's also a longer history of doing randomized trials in developing countries on health matters. One of the biggest debates in the healthcare in kind of health services has to do with whether to charge people for health products or not. And this is a situation where there's really sensible arguments on both sides. I mean, I can read a paragraph of each and be, you know, compelled, like, oh, this makes sense. Yes, we should be charging.
Charging for instance,
a bed net or to help protect family from malaria.
So rather than just Carolina for Haiti that distributes bed nets just to raise money to give out bed nets to people in Haiti.
Exactly. Just give them out for free. The argument being, when you give it out for free, that look, when you're that poor, you just don't have the money for it, and we need to.
And we can reach more people. That's an empiric question.
And it's cheaper per person to deliver it when you don't have to deal with collecting money.
But do more people actually use the nets if you give it to them for free?
Exactly. And then there's an argument that says, no, we need to create sustainable industries that produce them, and then also, if you get it for free, you're just not going to use it because you didn't pay for it, so you don't value it.
And you did, and you've covered research in the book that shows
that giving it out for free was far better. Now, this was done in Kenya, in a setting in which there had already been some distribution of free bed nets to certain types of households, like pregnant women and children under five. And so we do need to see more of this type of research to see whether this result holds elsewhere. But the result was very striking, and giving out a free bed net also led to higher demand a year later. When somebody else went out a year later to see, you know, who would actually be willing to pay for it. So it didn't create some sort of an entitlement effect either, that you gave away something for free and then all of a sudden they expected it to be free forever.
Wow, that again has large population impacts for obviously malaria. You have two examples. I wonder if you can comment on from your book and how this plays out. One is this linkage between education and healthcare and deworming, and the other has to do with one of the really probably what is the most common killer of children around the world: diarrheal illnesses.
Right. So these are two of our favorite examples of things which we think are quite ready for. I mean, not. For being scaled up, and one of them has already been scaled up at a very large level and needs to do more. So we saw researchers that were part of our nonprofit and professors at Harvard and Berkeley did a series of studies, and that's, I think, one of the key points here, all aimed at saying, how can we increase school attendance? There's many different methods we can do. For instance, we can do the simple thing, like let's pay people to go to school. Let's provide free lunches. Let's provide free uniforms. Let's provide some scholarships. Let's provide textbooks. Let's test these all out side by side. And the last one they tested, well, not chronologically, but is giving children a simple pill to deworm them. Now, intestinal worm infestations are very high in sub-Saharan Africa, in this particular part of Kenya as well. It's right near Lake Victoria. And when children received this pill and thus later did not have the worms, they were much healthier and more likely to go to school. It tells two striking stories. One, how important health is for school attendance. That one of the reasons why children don't attend is simply that they're not healthy.
They don't feel good.
Improve their health, they go to school.
Yep.
And the second is it's just a nice demonstration of a very simple, elegant, but process in which we test out several things side by side. If we have a common purpose saying, let's improve school attendance, we can test out several methods side by side and find out for every dollar we now put in to one of these methods, which one will produce the most improvement in school attendance.
And I love your example, because I think the cost for an additional year of attendance of deworming is $3.50. And giving out uniforms, which may not be intuitive as to why that would increase school attendance, but you talk about in your book that it decreases the stigma. People can't afford clothes and the right clothes to come to school, but that's 25 times more.
Exactly. Exactly. And so this is one of the reasons why this has become something we've championed around the world. And it's a big part of the Proven Impact Initiative, which is our attempt at IPA, that's IPA's Innovations for Poverty Action. And the Proven Impact Initiative is our attempt to reach out to donors around the world, small and large, to help them learn about what evidence there is and how can they put their money behind something that has more evidence behind it.
And you talk about towards the end of your book that seven ideas that work. One of them is, you know, chlorine dispensers for clean water. I was down in Haiti doing some volunteer work a few months ago, and it's clear the need for clean water is one of the, if not the most important imperative for population health down there.
That's exactly right. And this is a good example where there's been a huge number of methods tried to improve the quality of the water that people have in their house. And again, in a similar approach that we took to the improving school attendance, we compared about 5 or 6 different methods to improve the quality of the water, the cleanliness of the water. And there was a very simple nudge that was designed by our researchers that was a simple chlorine dispenser that was put by the well. And the point here was that when you get your water from the well, you then have the chlorine right there. And you put a little dollop of chlorine in the vat of water, and by the time you walk home, it swishes together and your water is clean. And by putting it right at the source, then it just made it part of the same process. Whereas if it was at home, the reality is when you hand out little chlorine bottles at home, it just doesn't get used as much. So the trick was, how do you get it into right into that kind of the decision-making process so that it's seamless, so that it's thoughtless? And that's a key to most things that you want to do when you're trying to change, modify behavior. Is, you know, the best way of doing it is always to make it so that the behavior gets modified without having to think about it, that it just becomes a natural byproduct of one's environment. And when that can happen, then you're much more likely to see changes take place in actual behavior. And this is a lesson that is true in America as well as developing countries. And this is one of the things that's been fun about some of this research, is searching for some of those key insights that transcend across cultures, that really just get at how we as individuals make decisions and aren't about whether we're poor or rich, but just understanding our psyche and how it affects our daily decisions.
Well, Dean, I think on that note, we should thank you on behalf of your health listeners. You know, you talk about in your introduction that the type of research that you do for you and your coworkers, you say it's engaging, thought-provoking, and inspiring. And I think your book is engaging, thought-provoking, inspiring.
Thank you.
All of our listeners out there, we've been talking with Dean Carlin, the author of a new book called More Than Good Intentions. How can people assume they can go to Amazon and order it in a variety of other ways?
Yep. It's sold at bookstores all over the U.S. Amazon, obviously, is the most common place I see people going to.
And we'll have a little bit more conversation with Dean and behind the scenes. But thank you so much for being our guest today, spending time, which as you articulate in your book, time spent doing one thing is time not spent doing something else. So
no, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
We really appreciate talking with Dean Carlin, author of More Than Good Intentions. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And Christy is on vacation this week. We do allow her to take a vacation every now and then, but we're fortunate that we've got a second guest on our show today. We'd like to welcome Adam Searing of the North Carolina Justice Center back to Your Health, because Adam, you have been on the show before.
Yes, and enjoyed it, and happy to be here today.
And for our audience, Adam Searing joined the Justice Center as director of the North Carolina Health Access Coalition in 1997, and they are really one of the leading advocate for health care reform to meet the needs of uninsured and underinsured people across North Carolina. And you are a Tar Heel native and have a degree in law and public health from University of North Carolina as well.
That's right, and grew up in Chapel Hill.
Well, it's great to have you back on the show. I think when we last had you on the show, we were in the throes of thinking about federal health care reform and how that might play out. And we also had Congressman David Price on the show. And a lot has happened over the last 2 years.
Yeah, I'll say.
up until this current legislative session, Adam, because I know we wanted to talk about what's been happening in the North Carolina legislature. We want to talk about federal health care reform and what it means for North Carolina. We want to talk about the health marketplace exchange and then some of the work that you are doing with elderly adults as well. But just to start us out, I mean, what has the last 2 years been like for you and the work that you all have done up until, let's say, the last 2 or 3 months? What have you been really doing?
Well, really what's happened in the last 2 years is that finally as a country we said, look, we're going to make a commitment that no one should have to go bankrupt just because they get sick anymore in our country. That's a promise that every other wealthy democracy makes to its citizens. And finally, through healthcare reform at the national level, we decided we're going to do that here as well.
And so federal health care legislation was passed, and what for most people, they probably know it's passed, but what are two or three of the most significant things that occurred or would occur under the federal legislation that was passed within the last 18 months?
Well, look, I mean, this is not perfect. Politics is never perfect, and people have very different ideas about how healthcare reform should look like. The way we did it in our country is a very, very unique American way of doing things. We didn't just sweep away the old system and institute a single payer system like, for instance, Canada has. We kept things as they are, so most people get their health insurance or their big company, they keep that. And what we did was over the last couple of years, we're gradually adding more and more people to the system until really in 2014 when almost everybody gets brought in. So far, what we've done is we've set up a high-risk pool so that people who can afford a premium but are pretty sick can come in and buy coverage.
So that people who have breast cancer or have heart disease and may be excluded under many plans?
Right. It's either excluded or quoted premiums like $2,000 a month. I mean, I've met many people who are in that boat. They could buy, if they were able to afford a $300 a month premium, then they could, which is still expensive for many people, but a lot better than $2,000, they could go ahead and buy care. Another example, children up to age 26, they can now stay on their parents' plans, regardless of whether they're in college or not. Big boon to a lot of people I know. It's a tough job market out there, and their kids being able to graduate from college, stay on their plan, really makes a difference. Another thing, we've added a bunch of preventive care benefits to Medicare and reduced the drug costs that, especially for brand name drugs that seniors pay in our Medicare program. So that's making drugs more affordable and things like a free checkup and other preventive care for our seniors much more available.
So pretty far reaching for groups that otherwise may not have had access or optimal ability to have a care affordable.
Right. So far, big changes for the people who are affected. For a lot of people, still having trouble buying coverage because the main reforms for the national health reform law really don't go into effect until for another almost 2 years. So.
Well, I guess what strikes me, and I'm sure if Christy were here, she'd be saying the same thing. What strikes I think lots of providers, it may be differently, but over the last year, certainly since the coincide of the elections that radically changed the makeup of Republican-Democrat balance in state legislatures across the country and federally, is the vehemency of wanting to repeal the national healthcare legislation. Talk a little bit about I assume that is true from your perspective, and if so, did this catch you by surprise?
No, I mean the battle was the battle was fought during the run up to the passage of the Affordable Care Act. It was obviously very politically pitched battle. What's interesting, I think what I see more and more of is that there's a small minority of people who are still really vocal about repealing the Affordable Care Act, But as we go along, I think that the idea that we should just repeal all this has lost a lot of its appeal. To use a play on words there. The reason is what are you going to do? You're going to tell seniors that they should suddenly start paying 50% more for drugs? You're going to tell all these parents who have adult children on their health plans, oh, no, no more adult kids on the health plans. And, small businesses, we're going to take away your tax credits. So, it's on the rhetoric, it's nice to say, we should repeal this. But the problem is, one, it actually costs a lot of money to repeal it. It does save money in the federal budget. You got to find that somewhere. And two, I think that most people are like the kind of as they find out more about what's happening, they like what is included in the Affordable Care Act, and they're more supportive of it.
I know North Carolina, the legislature wanted the state to follow, two dozen other states that have essentially almost sued the federal government to disengage from this, but it sounds like that didn't occur in North Carolina, at least joining that lawsuit.
No, the governor actually vetoed that bill. And what was interesting about that was our attorney general said, look, you guys, legislature, you've passed this bill to repeal so-called health care reform in North Carolina, but this is really going to impact our ability to get some pretty big funds through our Medicaid program. I don't think you guys have thought this through, that there's a lot of unintended consequences here. And the governor said, wait a second, this doesn't really make any sense. If the Supreme Court decides that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional for North Carolina, just like it is for everybody else. Why do we really need to get in the middle of this?
So that was really more of a political ploy than any real impact on the ground.
Yeah, I think political rhetoric sounds great, but, rubber meets the road. I don't think a lot of people are seeing that this is some huge, horrible change that has happened. Most people have the same coverage they've had before. I think one thing that people are worried about is increasing healthcare costs, and I think that's perfectly legitimate, and we're starting to get a handle on those. But it's like trying to turn around an oil tanker. Nothing's going to change that immediately.
Well, I know we're going to need to take a short break, but I know when we come back, I really want to talk about what's happening with Medicaid, because both Medicare and Medicaid drivers of state health budgets, federal health dollars, and large numbers of population health. And so we'll come back and we'll talk about that and where we're heading with that. We've been talking with Adam Searing of the North Carolina Justice Center. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And Christy's away on a vacation this week, but we're having a really interesting conversation with Adam Searing of the North Carolina Justice Center about changes in healthcare reform. We were just talking about the implementation of the federal healthcare reform in North Carolina. And really, Adam, one of the big things that's really impacted and will, I think, impact on lots of millions of people across the state is the Medicaid, what's happened federally and state in terms of Medicaid changes. Tell us what's happened.
Well, first of all, let's just talk about what Medicaid is. I mean, Medicaid is not Medicare. Medicare is how we pay for health care for older folks, for seniors, and a few other people in our country. Medicaid is health care that's administered both by the state and federal governments, and it is health care primarily for children, who make up the highest number of Medicaid recipients, people with really severe disabilities, and seniors. And all these people not only have to be pretty poor, but they have to either fall into one of these categories.
What is the how much money can you make and still be on Medicaid? Or another way of saying it is what is poor as Medicaid defines it?
Well, generally, they define it as under the poverty level, which is about $10,830 for one person in annual income. So, but if you're a child, your family can make slightly more than that. Depending on your health care disability, you can make slightly more than that. But it's certainly going to be people who are making you know, $20,000 or less. It doesn't Medicaid doesn't serve any childless adult. So, you know, this is another fiction that's out there. Somebody just, they don't want to work and they're just, you know, freeloading. Well, too bad. It doesn't matter how poor you are. You can be making $2 a year and you're not going to get Medicaid. So children, old folks, people with disabilities, all who are pretty poor.
And what's been happening federally and in the state of North Carolina?
Well, we've heard a lot about, you know, this Republican plan in Washington that just passed, which dismantled the Medicare program and said, here, take, get a coupon and go out and, you know, if you're under 55, you can get a coupon and go out and on the private market and see what kind of deal you can get. That's not been very popular. We've heard less about Medicaid, but in fact, Medicaid is under just as bad a threat. At the state level this year, in the budget that just passed this last week in North Carolina, hundreds of millions of dollars have been cut from Medicaid. And that means hundreds of millions of dollars from care from children, seniors, and people with severe disabilities. The Republican budget didn't specify exactly where those cuts would come from.
Almost $2 billion, right?
Yes, almost $2 billion in total, once you figure in the federal government's contributions. It's actually a little bit less than that now. I think it's, you know, 1.75, but it's a huge, huge amount. What's on the table over the next 6 months to a year, so-called optional services. Optional services in North Carolina include things that most people wouldn't think are too optional, like dental care, eyeglasses, medical equipment, physical therapy, things like that. Also on the table are how much we pay the doctors who take care of people on Medicaid.
Uh-oh. So, I don't like where this conversation is going.
Some people are laughing and say, oh, those doctors, they can take these hits. Well, you know, we already don't pay doctors very much to take care of people who are on Medicaid. We do better than many other states, but not the best. And frankly, you know, we ought to pay doctors who see these patients for very often very complex medical problems. We ought to pay them what it costs to take care of these people.
So the big concern with the cuts in services that involve vision and hearing and probably mental health and physical therapy and the addition of cuts to providers and probably hospitals for those services are that there will be reduced access and reduced care for those who are most vulnerable in our society.
Exactly. And in a society where, you know, I saw that today that CEOs in North Carolina all got collectively averaged about a 30% increase in their income last year to an average of close to $4 million a year. And that's just North Carolina-based companies. And so in a society when we can easily pay between $4 and $10 million to people who just run companies in North Carolina, but yet we need to make millions of dollars in cuts to the most vulnerable people in our state, children, the elderly, people with these severe disabilities, none of these people are going to be able to go out and buy health insurance on the private market. Many, even if they could afford it. No one would ever want to sell an insurance policy to someone with, you know, huge disabilities because the health costs would be so high. These people are going to get hurt.
Well, tell us, you know, one thing I know that that you have been working tirelessly for is helping to develop a rational and justifiable health exchange marketplace. If you can, because this is a very complicated thing that I don't think even most providers understand. Help us understand, what is this health exchange marketplace, and what was the real controversy in the North Carolina legislature, maybe still is, about the composition of that group who was making decisions ultimately in North Carolina?
Well, here's the deal. We're back to step away from Medicaid for a minute, step back to health reform. Part of health reform is to make a more reasonable marketplace for people to buy health insurance plans. We didn't sweep away all the plans. In fact, we want to make it easier for people, like in small businesses and individuals, most of the people who are out there uninsured. We want to make a place where you can easily compare health plans, just like on a website like Travelocity or Consumer Reports. You can compare health plans, apples to apples comparison, see who's going to give you the best price at the benefits you want. You get to choose. And you know, find a good deal. Right now, you can't do that in North Carolina or really any other state. And each state under the National Health Reform Law is required to set up some sort of, they call it a health benefits exchange, but really it's just this marketplace where you would go and choose between these health plans and see where, you know, where you could get the best deal.
So maybe if you were, the analogy, of course, is if you're looking for a car, you could go online and see what 10 dealers are all offering for the same car, which you could do pretty easily now, and it's actually very effective.
Right. Yeah. Although, yeah, there's a twist with the dealers, but I would say, like, you can go on Consumer Reports and get they'll give you
a more unbiased.
Yeah, an unbiased. Yeah, and therein lies the difference.
Yep.
Because in North Carolina, there was a bill put in to set this sort of marketplace up, and guess who wrote the majority of the bill?
Probably industry is my guess.
Industry did. The insurance industry wrote the majority of it, the big health insurance companies, and frankly, some of the that joined in by some of the folks who run the hospitals and then some of the folks from the physicians, the medical society.
And what was wrong with what they were proposing?
Well, it was not a Consumer Reports type website. It was a, you know, car dealer will give you a great deal website, what they're proposing. It included selling advertising. It included new taxes on people who buy health plans on the website to finance it, along with the advertising. So if you want to go buy a health plan in that website, you'd have to pay an additional tax that you wouldn't if you weren't on that website.
So there may be some benefits, but not at the level of what you would say is the basis for consumer trust in what you're doing.
The independent folks who looked at this, at our bill, thought it was the worst or second worst in the entire country. It was a joke. It was.
And did this pass the legislature?
It passed the House. It did not pass the Senate. It will be eligible for consideration next year.
Well, we've gone from really bad news to not good news. How about a little piece of good news? I know that you are doing some work, a project that you all are working on called Campaign for Better Care. Tell us a little bit about that, because I think this is, again, innovative and suggests that there is a lot of need out there that can be filled.
Absolutely. We're very excited about this project. We had a great community meeting in Raleigh a few weeks ago. We're going to be in Greenville this week, actually, on Thursday. And what we're doing is we're asking people, you know, come and tell us your stories about trying to get health care in our current system, and come and tell us how you think we could do better. For example, you know, a lot of people have trouble calling up their primary care doctor and getting, you know, a live person on the phone when they have a question. You know, I know that's not the case for you, but some places do. Or, you know, when they have a loved one, especially someone who's older and needs a lot of complex care and they're in the hospital, that person may see 10 different doctors, none of whom talk to each other. And there's no sort of coordinated care plan, especially, we see this especially in more rural areas of the state. So our idea is to talk to people, find out what their concerns are, what their problems are, and we're already getting an earful, as you can imagine, and then come up with some more very concrete ideas about how we can better coordinate care. We have a good, you know, basis to do this in North Carolina. We have lots of innovative programs like community care, which we can't get into here, but, you know, I think we can do that. We just need to go around and listen to what people are saying and telling us what's wrong and do better.
Well, I know this is an important area. I've got a family member right now who's an elderly family member who had a small fracture in the leg, and trying to find out information from a provider out of state, even though I'm a physician, and access and coordinating care and getting information to my loved one and finding answers and getting involved adjunct providers is very difficult. And here I've got the level of expertise that I have. I know it must be even harder for, you know, thousands of people across the state.
Right. And we want to hear, like, maybe we should come interview you, Adam. You could tell your story. I find it so fascinating that almost everyone I talk to has a story about how our healthcare system, you know, could do better, especially when that they're dealing with care of an older loved one. I mean, it really shows that we could have a lot of room for improvement, that the battle's not just about access to care like we've been talking about so far, but the way we organize care. And I think there are a lot of ways we can do better. We just have to identify the problem and put in place some solutions.
Adam, where can people who want to find out more information about your work, North Carolina Health Access Coalition, what's the best way of finding out?
The best way to find out is to just go to our website, ncjustice.org. There's a whole section on healthcare there. We have a whole section on our campaign for better care, how you can get involved, how you can come to some of the meetings we're having. We love to have participation. We also love to hear stories from people who are dealing with healthcare problems or the healthcare, you know, the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. You Google my name and you'll find everything you want to know about me and how to get up with me.
And again, that's Adam Searing, not Adam Goldstein.
Right. Yeah.
we want to thank Adam Searing, the director of the North Carolina Health Access Coalition, North Carolina Justice Center, being a guest, a repeat guest on our show, and bringing to us serious issues that are affecting people across North Carolina, across states, across the whole country. Thank you for your work on advocacy on behalf of those who really are perhaps least noticed sometimes in society. Thank you.
Thank you.
We want to thank Adam Searing for joining us today on Your Health. If you've enjoyed his interview as well as the interview that we had with Dean Carlin, you can listen to Behind the Scenes for a few additional comments that our guests have had today. If you have your own comments and stories, you can send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and now even iTunes, a free podcast from the iTunes Store. We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guests today, Dean Carlin and Adam Searing. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.